This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
What Janet Yellen said today and what it means, no easy story to do, by the way. Also, a little bit about money in politics. A little bit about a lot of money in politics, actually, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Thursday, the 11th of February. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. A funny thing happened on the way to a market route today. Oh, don't get me wrong, it was still a route, just not as big as it might have been. A little bit before 3 o'clock or so East Coast time, there was a report out of the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, that OPEC, the cartel, might, and you got to stress here, might, be ready to work together on a crude oil production cut. It's not like we haven't heard these rumors before, but this one bumped oil futures contracts and the major stock indexes off the lows they had been trading at all day. And low those lows were, in part because of one Janet Louise Yellen. The Fed chair spent a second day on Capitol Hill today, the Senate this time, answering basically the same questions she got yesterday and answering them basically the same way, including this line, which I did mention yesterday, quote, financial conditions in the United States have recently become less supportive of growth, end quote. Okay, fine. Well, not fine. Nobody wants lower growth. But what exactly does financial conditions mean? Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports from New York on that and what, if anything, the Fed can do about it.
Yellen was kind enough to leave breadcrumbs so we can better understand what she means. Two are pretty straightforward. One may need a little explanation. First,
declines in broad measures of equity prices.
When the stock market is down, people feel less rich and tend to spend less. Also,
further appreciation of the dollar.
The strong dollar makes American stuff more expensive abroad, hurting U.S. exporters. Yellen also worries about this other aspect of financial conditions.
Higher borrowing rates for riskier borrowers.
What that means is people aren't willing to put their money in riskier investments. These companies always have to pay higher interest rates, but it's worse than usual. You can see this play out in the bond market. One gauge of how worried investors are about the future is the difference between the high interest rates for bonds of riskier companies and the ultimate safe bet, U.S. Treasuries.
This spread has gotten wider and wider and wider and wider.
Steve Blitz, chief economist at ITG, says when borrowing money gets really expensive, bad things happen.
It means that jobs won't be created and spending won't happen, and some of these firms may have to shut down.
As far as this and the other financial conditions bugging Yellen, former Fed economist Ann Owen says the central bank toolbox only does so much.
Unfortunately, many of these issues are not going to be directly fixed by a change in the interest rates. In some cases, they're actually going to get worse.
There's not a lot of cheer in Yellen's testimony, but if nothing else, it's the voice of a Fed that understands its limits. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Back to oil for a second here. We're going to see what happens tomorrow after that OPEC item I started with. But traders today drove the price of crude down more, I ought to say, off another 4.5%. Gas is cheap, that's great, but falling oil isn't all that good when oil's what you've got to sell. We're going to be talking to people in oil-producing countries over the next couple of weeks to find out how they are dealing with this crude collapse. Daniel Pardo is the BBC correspondent in Caracas, Venezuela, the world's number 8 oil producer. Daniel, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me, if you would, how the collapse in oil prices is being felt down there.
Well, after the drop of oil price, obviously the government had to stop spending as much as they did before, and that generated a huge impact in the recent parliamentary elections in December, where the government lost for the first time in 17 years of socialist rule.
Right. So what's not happening down there that used to happen? Are, social welfare programs getting money? What about, gas subsidies, things like that?
The government says that even with the drop of oil price, they will continue spending most of the money in social programs. However, in the past 2 years, we've seen that most of those social programs have been reduced in some way. Let me give you an example.
Sure.
For instance, the government's health program mainly has been to install hundreds of ambulatory care centers all over the country mm-hmm. with Cuban doctors in an agreement that the government has with Cuba to exchange oil with doctors. According to the opposition, 68% of those centers are not working.
Venezuela is a member of OPEC, as are Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, three countries that are continuing to pump oil on the market, even though the price is falling. Do you suppose the Venezuelan government has gone to its fellow OPEC members and said, what are you doing here?
Yes, they have several times. Actually, President Nicolas Maduro has insisted that production should be cut or there should be an agreement to increase the price of oil.
So let's say oil stays, as a lot of analysts are saying, at $30 a barrel, maybe even $20 a barrel. As bad as things are now in Venezuela, what does it look like in, 2 years?
It's going to be bad, because the only thing that Venezuela has to save itself is oil. The government is saying that it's launching different programs to increase production that doesn't depend on oil. So, for instance, agriculture or... Mm-hmm. But that's only going to take a while, right, to develop a whole industry that is not oil dependent. So many people are predicting that this government is not going to be able to stay in power.
Daniel Pardo, the BBC Mundo correspondent in Caracas, Venezuela. Daniel, thanks very much.
Thank you.
How bad could the aforementioned market rout have been? Here's how bad. The Dow off 1.6% today, and people were happy about it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're going to continue with energy here for a bit. These are dark days for coal. Cheap, fracked natural gas is eating coal's lunch in the electric power markets. International demand is low, and the Obama administration says the industry has to spend billions of dollars to clean things up. Yes, yesterday the Supreme Court temporarily blocked the EPA's attempt to clean up carbon dioxide emissions, but the government does still require that coal plants clean up other pollutants. So Reed Frazier from the Allegheny Front went inside a plant in Pennsylvania to find out just how those pollution controls work.
What does it take to keep 100,000 tons of pollution out of the air? To find out, I had to take a bit of a hike.
Okay, we're climbing up 6 flights of stairs.
You feeling it?
You okay?
Sulfur in coal is a big cause of air pollution. To take the sulfur out, the Homer City Generating Station just east of Pittsburgh is putting in thousands of air filters. Todd Kohlross is the lead engineer for the project. He takes me to a room where there are hundreds of holes in the floor.
If you look down, these holes are where all the bags are going to slide in.
Inside each hole will go long tubes covered with fabric bags. They're basically super long air filters. Outside, a tall crane moves steel beams into a brand new building that houses those filters. Total cost for the project, $750 million. That's a lot of cash, even for a company like GE, which owns the plant. James Shapiro is a senior vice president with GE Energy Financial Services, and he's my host for the day.
So when you ask, like, how expensive, why it's so expensive, I mean, just look at the size of this project.
Yeah, it's big. Kohlross points to metal air ducts that will handle the exhaust for the new scrubber system. These ducts are bigger than my house.
It's not like you're... Take your furnace and put it on steroids. You're trying to heat your house. We're trying to take care of 2 million homes.
That's how many buildings Homer City can power when it's running at full steam. It feeds the grid that powers New York, Philadelphia, and Chicago. Around the country, dozens of plants are putting in similar pollution controls. They're all trying to meet new clean air rules written by the Obama administration. These include the mercury and air toxics standards, though the courts may still weigh in on that rule. James Shapiro said Homer City faced a tough decision when the rules were first announced.
You didn't have much choice. You either put on the pollution controls or you stop running.
Which brings us back inside to those huge fabric air filters. The plant will spray the polluted exhaust with a lime powder, which turns the gases and tiny particles in the exhaust into bigger particles. These bigger particles stick to the fabric bags.
40,000 between the two units, 40,000 bags.
The EPA says the costs of the new rules will raise electricity rates 3%. But in exchange, they'll prevent 11,000 deaths a year. And on top of that, will prevent thousands of cases of asthma and heart attack and save the economy billions in health costs. At Homer City, all the bad stuff in the exhaust goes into the bags and not our lungs. The plant is on schedule to meet its final deadline of April. There's one small problem, though. Those new filters don't catch carbon dioxide, the main cause of global warming. The EPA plans to limit carbon dioxide emissions from coal plants, but that proposal hit an obstacle this week when the Supreme Court issued a stay on the EPA rule until a lower court hears the case. Still, just in case, Homer City is applying for permission to use cleaner burning natural gas. In Homer City, Pennsylvania, I'm Reed Frazier for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Just ridiculous. It sounded like a plan to sell air. Tudor's own father called the idea wild and ruinous.
Not air, ice. But first, let's do the numbers. Oh, mandolins? I don't know. The Dow Industrial's off 254 points today, 1.6%, 15,660. The Dow off 411 points earlier in the day. The NASDAQ down 16 points at the bell, nearly 0.4%, 4266. The S&P 500 declined 22 points, 1.2%, ended things at 1829. Financials took the brunt of it today. Bank of America and Citigroup off more than 6%. Morgan Stanley, JP Morgan Chase, and Goldman Sachs all fell more than 4%. Some corporate news of note. There's a report by Bloomberg that Boeing is being investigated by the SEC over how it accounted for some of its costs and sales figures. Shares in Boeing tumbled 6.8% on the day. Bond prices rose. Here you go. I said it yesterday. I'll say it again. Forget Janet Yellen. Look at the bond market. The bond yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.65%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Democratic presidential race makes a stop in Milwaukee, Wisconsin tonight. Another debate as that contest gets ever more fraught. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, coming off his big win in New Hampshire, has a lot of big plans for new social programs. Big, expensive social programs that, according to Sanders anyway, Wall Street is going to help pay for. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has a look at how that's going to work.
Sanders' critics call many of his policies, like free tuition at public colleges, unrealistic. During his victory speech in New Hampshire this week, he spoke to them directly.
I will tell you how we're going to pay for it. We're going to impose a tax on Wall Street speculation.
He wants a sales tax on trades, 50 cents for every $100 traded. Robert Polin is an economics professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He hasn't been working with the Sanders campaign, but co-wrote a paper that lays out the so-called Robin Hood tax.
The idea that we're going to tax Wall Street trading and, in Bernie Sanders' proposal, use the money to fund free college education is, I think Robin Hood would get behind that.
The idea for a financial transaction tax, or FTT, isn't new. It's been around for decades. It does reduce that speculation that Sanders mentioned, and high-frequency trading becomes less frequent. We know this because taxes like this already exist.
I don't think the UK stock market is, you know, a paragon of beauty, but it functions. It functions more or less as the U.S. market does, and they operate with a tax.
These transaction taxes are becoming a lot more common, so it's harder to hide from them.
Jared Bernstein is a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He supports an FTT, but thinks the one Sanders is proposing is a bit high.
We don't know that it's too high. What we do know is that it's higher than most of the other FTTs out there and higher than the kinds of proposals that we typically see.
If you go too high, companies just won't trade on your exchange anymore. Stephen Rosenthal is with the Tax Policy Center.
That happened to Sweden several decades ago when it introduced a very large transaction tax. The trade simply moved to the UK and other jurisdictions.
Which is what many opponents of the tax worry would happen here. The US actually already has a tiny one.
We collect a small fee to fund the SEC. The tax would be much larger, but it would be collected presumably in the same way.
And that tax to fund the Securities and Exchange Commission is paid by investors large and small.
So administratively, this is pretty easy. Politically, though, the matter is much harder.
Because lots of people like the idea of taxes on Wall Street, not so much taxes on my street. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Taxing Wall Street after the election is one thing. Taking money from Wall Street beforehand would seem to be entirely another. See also Hillary Clinton and those very well-paid speeches to Goldman Sachs and campaign contributions Wall Street's made to candidates practically forever. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson looks at Wall Street and presidential politics.
Wall Street gave more than $100 million to presidential candidates and their super PACs during 2015. And let's just say aloud the thing that you're probably thinking.
This is a massive amount of money.
Yeah. Sheila Kromholtz is the executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics, which crunched this data.
Finance is, year after year, cycle after cycle, the number one source of campaign cash.
She says, yes, Hillary Clinton's campaign has taken in more than any other, almost $3 million last year. But when you throw super PACs into the mix, Jeb Bush takes a big lead with $34.5 million, double Clinton's tally with her super PACs. But these so-called Wall Street donations, by and large, aren't coming from corporate funds. In fact, firms like Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan Chase don't allow that.
90% of the money is coming from individuals, and these include deep-pocketed donors.
Mega donors giving millions to super PACs. But there are also individuals employed at Wall Street companies who often give smaller donations directly to the candidate's campaign. Bruce Fried is the president of the Center for Political Accountability. He says companies shy away from giving corporate funds, in part because they worry it'll upset the public or shareholders. But individuals?
There's an expectation that the folks at the top will give, and it's sort of informally included in their compensation package, but it's not explicit.
Companies can suggest executives give or attend some event, but they can't mandate it, says Ronald Jacobs. He's chair of the political law practice at Venable. And in his experience, companies are more focused on local or congressional campaigns than presidential.
It's a politician who represents our district, or it's a politician who's on the committee that oversees, you know, our industry or the agency that regulates our industry. Those kind of targeted connections.
Which brings us to the question, what are donors to a presidential campaign hoping to get anyway? Stephen Ansala-Behar is a professor of government at Harvard.
It could be more of a, I want to be socially powerful, throw my weight around and show how big a person I am.
He says if you think of these donations as an investment, the return actually isn't that good. I know, this goes against everything we think we know about money and politics.
And yet, that's what the literature says. And there are like hundreds of studies on this. It's very hard to see any consistent, statistically meaningful patterns.
He says these donations add up to a tiny fraction of Wall Street revenues. If they worked better, he thinks we'd actually see a lot more money in politics. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Meeting the demands of the world's biggest consumer class is no easy thing. I'm not talking about us here. I'm talking about China. The Chinese are hungry for oil and food and increasingly timber. Luckily for them, one of the world's biggest natural forests lies just to its south across the border in Myanmar. The government in Myanmar bans timber exports, but as Marketplace's Rob Schmitz reports, China keeps finding a way around that.
The streets of Myanmar are lined with sawmills. They're also lined with logs as big as cars, teak, rosewood, and golden camphor, all of them felled illegally across the border in Burma from old-growth forests and brought to the Chinese side to be cut down into furniture.
These trees were several hundred years old.
Li Xiaomei and her husband Li Jianli run this sawmill. Business is good. Demand from China's growing middle class is strong. And that's why across the border, Chinese crews cut down each year swathes of forest twice the size of New York City. Thing is, all of this is illegal. Burma has banned the export of timber to protect its old-growth forests. And across the border in the Burmese state of Kachin, there's an ongoing civil war. Furniture maker Lee says this makes it easier for Chinese companies to log.
They're very poor over there, and the local militia bosses will sign contracts to cut a mountainside. Our Chinese companies build roads, bridges, and schools for their people, and in return, they sell us timber.
According to the Environmental Investigation Agency, an international NGO, more than $500 million worth of timber has come across this border. The agency's Julian Newman has visited the area and written reports on the cross-border timber trade.
The problem is that China is a hungry nation in terms of timber. It's got a deficit between its local production and what it needs. And it looks to many countries, including Myanmar, to get its raw materials from.
Newman suspects China's government plays a part in this illegal trade, too.
We're talking about almost 1 million cubic meters of wood come across the border a year of logs, which are illegal under Myanmar law. That's not something you can hide easily. Therefore, there must be some complicity at the border.
At the border crossing in Pyenma, a Chinese guard armed with a machine gun orders me to delete pictures I took of the border. It's a sensitive place. Apart from illegal timber, drugs make their way across this border, and there's a war going on just beyond it. But traffic from Burma has been slow recently. A year ago, the Burmese army arrested 155 Chinese loggers, sentencing them to life in prison. They were eventually pardoned when China's government agreed to halt the import of Burmese timber. The ban has only been in effect a few months, but furniture maker Yang Xili says it's had a huge impact on Pyenma's economy.
Before, there were more than 300 sawmills here. Now there are fewer than 30. There used to be at least 60,000 people in this little town. Now you can't find 6,000.
Young says his salary of $5,000 a month has been cut in half. And he's sculpting the last of his timber reserves into tables, chairs, and desks. But there's hope, he says.
We've been told the government will lift the ban in March.
Half of Burma is covered by natural forest. It's projected that by 2030, 115,000 square miles, an area the size of Arizona, will be cut down. And in this Chinese border town, loggers eagerly wait to do just that. In Pyenma, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
This is going to ring hollow to those of you in many parts of the country right now, so apologies in advance, but we are having a crazy heat wave out here in L.A., like 90 degrees this week. Crazy. Thanks to the magic of air conditioning and refrigeration, we're pretty much fine, thanks. But a couple of hundred years ago, that temperature disparity was a business opportunity. Lauren Redness wrote about it, and an entrepreneur named Frederick Tudor in her new book. It's called Thunder and Lightning: Weather, Past, Present, and Future.
Frederick Tudor was an early American businessman. In 1805, he had the preposterous-sounding idea to harvest ice from frozen Massachusetts lakes, to pack those blocks of ice onto ships, and to send them to be sold in the hottest parts of the world. To most people at the time, to sell ice from New England in India sounded just ridiculous. It sounded like a plan to sell air. Tudor's own father called the idea wild and ruinous. On his first voyage in 1806, he sailed to Martinique with a ship full of ice. But when he arrived, there was nowhere to store it. So unsurprisingly, Tudor's ice melted away before he could make anything close to a profit. In some years, the winter wasn't cold enough to provide ice to sell. He was thrown in prison for debt more than once. And apparently on one occasion, The creditors were chasing him to the shore just as his ships pulled away. In 1833, he made his first shipment of ice to Calcutta, and people didn't know what they were looking at. They thought that maybe this ice had some magical or supernatural or demonic quality. And yet, the ice lasted, and these shipments turned out to be wildly profitable. Today, he's mostly forgotten, but in the mid-19th century, he was known as the Ice King, and he was renowned as a visionary.
Lauren Redness there about her new book, Thunder and Lightning, Weather, Past, Present, and Future. This final note on the way out today, in which Whole Foods becomes extremely Whole Food-ish. The company's in the middle of rolling out a brand new store brand, 365, these new shops are going to be called. Smaller, just as natural, organic, healthy, you know the drill. Here's the twist, though. Bloomberg reported today, and the company confirms, that the new stores will also host smaller pop-up shops, record stores, perhaps, vinyl, of course, or tattoo parlors. Not making this up. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 254 points today, 1.6%, and that was good, remember. The NASDAQ down 16 points, nearly 0.4%. The S&P 500 off 22 points, 1.2%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.